I think we tended as political scientists not to think about the importance of nativism because there was this period, the end of the Second World War until about the 1970s and 80s, where it seemed that nationalism and nativism and all these things had gone away with the European integration project. I think in retrospect, it's that 30 years that's going to be the historical exception.
Welcome to A History of Xenophobia, from the gold mines to the rise of the far right today. My name is Ariel Glynn, and I'm the host of this History Hope podcast series. History Hope is based at the School of History at University College Dublin in Ireland. You can find a huge range of podcasts and videos showcasing historical research on our website, historyhope.ie. You can also follow us on various social media, and if you want to get in contact with us about the series, please email info@historyhope.ie. David Art is a professor of political science at Tufts University in the United States. Professor Art's research interests include extremist political parties and movements, politics of history and memory, and comparative historical analysis in the social sciences, all of which we'll touch on at various times today in our discussion. So he's the author of two excellent monographs, both of which are relevant for what we'll be speaking about, but especially his monograph, Inside the Radical Right, The Development of Anti-Immigrant Parties in Western Europe, will be particularly prominent in our discussion. But he's also penned The Politics of the Nazi Past in Germany and Austria, and that will also, towards the end of our discussion, maybe come in. Both were published with Cambridge University Press. He's also written a number of extremely important articles recently on themes that are highly relevant for this podcast, including papers entitled The AfD and the End of Containment in Germany and the Myth of Global Populism, which we will also perhaps touch on if we have time. So, David, there's a growing emphasis on the success of the radical right or the far right these days. But I think in your paper that I just mentioned, The Myth of Global Populism, you talk about how its support has been quite steady over the decades, and that the story of the radical right or the anti-immigrant right is one of success and failure. So how did you, when you were writing that book, how did you distinguish between what is success and what is failure?
Great. First, thanks a lot for inviting me and for everyone who has plowed through Inside the Radical Right. I wrote it 10 or 11 years ago, so it's somewhat dated in a lot of ways. But the way I defined success back then was really for a social scientific audience, because you need to get your dependent variable straight in the social sciences. So I define success, again, this is back writing in the 2006 to 2010, as three successive elections, national elections, when a radical right party got over 5%. And back about, 13 years ago, that was a good measure to really separate the strong parties, the Front National, from the failed parties. So the Front National in France, as opposed to the Front National Belge, which is one of the failed parties. And as you mentioned, there have been lots of far-right parties that have failed over time since the end of the Second World War in European politics. Most never really get off the ground. Now, 13 years on, we might define success a little bit differently. As you say, there's been stability in the radical right electorate over time, although there has been some growth, sort of increasing vote share, when Cass Moody has, documented that pretty well. But it's not dramatically different. So that is to say, perhaps we can say success, you can measure in different ways. I did it, in a very kind of what I thought was the crispest way to differentiate what I meant by success and what I meant by failure. That doesn't mean that they didn't influence the political, even the failed parties didn't influence political discourse. So that's why I defined it that way. We social scientists, kind of care very much about our independent and dependent variables. Historians and the humanities may care less about that stuff, but that's, kind of desperately important to political scientists, particularly in the United States. So you need a dependent variable, and that was the one I cast upon.
Yeah, I think it's a good metric. When I was reading again your book this morning, think about, does AfD then qualify? It had 4.7%, around 12%, 10%. So I thought, it was basically 5%. It's three consistent elections.
I mean, if you do that, if you round up, it would make it. Now, I wouldn't count the AfD in the 2013 as the radical right party yet, right? It was the party of economists. So, you know, I would say 2017, yes, 2021, yes, and now we'll see. So it could absolutely be, by my metric, that that now they have changed, right? So what was true by this, you know, the way I defined things back then has changed. So they could be deemed a success. Of course, there are different ways of talking about, you know, what the big picture is, right? Are they, there's the electoral scores, and then there's, you know, governing or not governing.
I welcome, you know, that metric, because there are, you know, several instances when a party comes from nowhere, features quite prominently in an election, and then there's this fallout that people think this is the beginning of something incredible, that, you know, it's unprecedented, and then very quickly that party dies away. So like Pim Fortuyn in the Netherlands, for instance, comes to mind, and you talk also about New Democracy in Sweden in the early 1990s. That they appear and disappear as quickly as they've arrived, almost.
That's true. Having said that, there have been a few new parties since I wrote Inside the Radical Right that I may add a few caveats, like the True Finns, perhaps, some of these anti-bailout parties like the AfD. So I think the sovereign debt crisis in particular, even more so than the refugee crisis, might have given birth to some of these new parties. But big picture, if you kind of look at who are the major players, the radical right today, and turn back the clock to the mid-1990s or early 2000s. So we're talking about the Austrian FPÖ. We're talking about whatever the far right is calling itself in France. We're talking about the Swiss People's Party, right? Pretty much, you know, with some exceptions, as you said, a picture of stability, not only in electorate, but who kind of the key, you know, the key players, the key parties are.
Yeah, you talk about how there are two things that are necessary for electoral persistence, and just having one by itself isn't enough. So the first is the nature of pre-existing resources for radical right party building. So that's usually that there is some other existent party that they can either transform or else learn from, perhaps.
Right.
And then the second is the reaction, and particularly the initial reaction of other political parties and civil society to their appearance. Can you expand on that?
Absolutely. And I would say that the two variables, one, the first, which I'll talk about, is the historical one. And then the second one, and maybe we'll spend more time talking about that, is the reaction. And that's sort of the timeless one. The first one is kind of very much rooted in, I guess it's a general argument about party building, but it was kind of dependent or rooted in the post-war, you know, the 30 glorious years, as the French call them, after the end of the Second World War. And, you know, it made the point that, you know, kind of just looking at empirically at the cases, it had been impossible for a radical right party to just sort of throw together a bunch of hardcore activists or anti-immigrant folks and cobble together a party which then, you know, persisted. It didn't happen. The parties that were succeeding in the 80s and 90s came from two sources. Either one, a nationalist subculture that existed in France, that existed in Belgium, and this was strong in some places and weak in others. So that is to say, these were the same people in many cases, or the same families, definitely the same myths and memories. A tradition of nationalism that I expand upon in the book. Either you had that as your pre-existing foundation, or radical right parties took over another party, so to speak. And, you know, the cases of this were the Danish People's Party, which used to be an anti-tax party, was called the Danish Progress Party before. Similar story in Norway, somewhat different story in Switzerland, but taking over a party that was essentially about something else, using that party, having that party structure, and then becoming a radical right party. Now, the AfD is interesting because it is a party that is building on what I would have described as not good historical resources. In Germany, they're poor for a whole lot of reasons. But it did have that kind of pre-existing cover in the IFDA of economists. My colleague Elizabeth Ivarsflaten in Norway talks about a reputational shield. So I think that this did kind of shield the IFDA in some ways, at least initially. So in the book, I argued, I made this case about, well, historically, just in terms of personnel, the initial leaders of the Front National, many trace their roots back to the cause of Algerie Française, or, directly back to agitating for that cause. So same people, right? Similarly, in the Vlaams Bloc, same people in the nationalist movements in Flanders. So that's the first one. That's the historical stuff. The second, I think, is, kind of now in this era of whatever we are, right, how to deal with the far right, this is kind of the timeless question. How does it matter how mainstream parties of all sorts react? And here, I think the big point of the book stands that parties do have choices. They've historically had choices about how to behave, and they've made different ones in different contexts.
Maybe coming back to the second part of that question, yep, about how the mainstream political parties and civil society react to the appearance of these radical right parties. You mention the concept of cordon sanitaire in your book. So maybe you can explain to people what that is and about when it's enacted and how significant that is.
No, thanks for that question. And it gives me the opportunity to kind of say that cordon sanitaire was maybe not the best term to use in the first place, but I've used it and so many others have used it that it's kind of out there now. I think there's another term that's slightly better that I've used in more recent writing called an anti-pact. And that is an explicit non-cooperation agreement by political parties not to cooperate with the far right. So same idea, but absence the sort of problematic epidemiology, right? So that's what I mean by that. And it's the same story in Germany today is similar to Germany in the 80s and early 90s, with that there's a total policy of non-cooperation that's enforced with the AfD, meaning that it is impossible, and we've seen attempts to do so being rebuffed as late as 2020, 2021, to try to test this strategy, to try to test this strength of this anti-pact in Germany, and haven't succeeded. So it remains very strong, and I believe the CDU-CSU that they're going to continue with it. So that's the sort of the most extreme anti-pacting one can see. And Sweden long had that. Wallonia still has it. France, an important case that also still has that strategy. The opposite is, and this became very clear in Austria and Switzerland in the 90s, is a strategy from mainstream parties saying there's nothing wrong with the radical right as a coalition partner. We do not sort of rule it out, not on democratic grounds, but on democratic choice grounds. Let's say we choose not to cooperate this. We think the preservation of these values is worth more than cooperating with the radical right. So Austrian political parties of both left and right have not done that. Swiss political parties ditto. So that's the extreme case of anti-pacting. And then you get cases in the middle and you get some change over time. The Netherlands, which you referred to earlier, that's an interesting case. In the 80s and 90s, there was an extremely strong anti-pacting arrangement against what was quite a small, political party at the time. But Lisp-Pim Fortuyn was a different story, in which the coalition markets or the pacting possibilities were open quite clearly. And the latest elections in the Netherlands, saw also this unclear, was Wilders going to be considered or not in coalition formation before the election? So in the Netherlands, that in-between case. So that's what I meant by it. And I think it's become a big deal in European politics, but also in the United States. There's a really good book that I recommend called How Democracies Die that kind of uses similar language to talk about gatekeeping and how elites have a role in democratic societies to particularly conservative elites to play the gatekeeping role. And the argument in this book, How Democracies Die, is that Republican Party basically failed to do that, letting in a radical right faction within it. So the United States would be kind of a case of no to use the original terminology, cordon sanitaire against the radical right. That's what I meant by that. Now, it can also be applied to the media. I think it works best at the level of political parties as something we can define and say crisply whether there is this or is there not. When you get to the media, it's a little bit more on a continuum, right? So how hostile are they? How open are they to the radical right? And the same thing with civil society, right? How much of a social cost, how much of a reputational cost do individuals bear? Do they bear none? Pretty much was the case in Austria and Italy as well, for in the 90s and continuing on. Or is life, you know, kind of made miserable for them in all sorts of ways, as was the case in Germany, Wallonia, and elsewhere, as I found inside the radical right. Now, that was fieldwork in roughly 2002 up through 2009, I want to say. So it might be that things on the ground have shifted somewhat in terms of civil reactions, but I do think that they matter. And I'm glad that people are paying more attention, researching those more.
I used to use the example of Hans Janmaat's party, the Centrum Democraten, that you mentioned in the Netherlands, that in the 1980s, when he was first elected to parliament, you know, there was huge public protests outside the parliament. There were, you know, attacks from anti-fascist kind of groups against him. And this seemed to wane then over time. And when you had Pim Fortuyn saying very similar things, there was very little protest against this. And then, you know, now today we have Geert Wilders, which, as you mentioned, you know, he was being kind of included potentially in governments. And now he's the deal maker, at least currently. So, you know, it changes over time as well. And you mentioned that as well, that cordon sanitaire can't really be enforced, you know, after the fact. You know, so if they're kind of aren't challenged that much, if there's kind of a lukewarm welcome, and then several years later, when they become stronger, they suddenly try to enact this, it's rarely successful.
That's what I thought, and still mostly do think, when I wrote Inside the Radical Right. Having said that, there's an interesting case, which we might be able to, someone is certainly looking at, I hope. And that's what's going on in Finland, because the True Finns were part of a bailout party before they radicalized to some degree, is my understanding, not being a specialist in Finnish politics. But at some point, there was a radicalization of the True Finns and then a adopting of a anti-PAC strategy with the party. So we'll see. There is some evidence from coming out from Sweden, a couple papers that I've read, suggesting that even though the anti-pacting strategy has diminished to some degree in Sweden, there is still a lasting stigmatization effect that strategy seemed to have had. So even if, you know, it were to be changed to some degree, it may have long lag effects. So, but we just don't know. I think, you know, as time piles on, we may have more, you know, findings on whether you can, in fact, successfully, you know, enact. I didn't find any examples back then when I wrote this of it working out that way.
So you've covered anti-pact kind of explanations for why sometimes parties might succeed and fail. You also referred there to this kind of coalition market, whether mainstream parties are going to include or exclude.
I would say that that's the same concept. So anti-pact, yeah, and coalition markets, right? Because the term in the United States, you need to explain to students, like, what's a coalition market? And then you say, well, in the vast majority of countries in Europe, you form coalition governments. But for me, anti-pacting and coalition market formation, that's the same idea, right? Sort of social norms and the social stigma that comes at the level of civil society and the media. Is a you know, these are all interrelated, of course, but they're separate. I think they're separate distinctively. So the coalition markets, I use that in past work. That's what I mean by PACs, anti-PACs.
And another important factor is, and this relates to the work of the radical right, but also the mainstream parties and their reaction to them, is whether mainstream parties try to co-opt their policies. That is, you know, basically take their policies, maybe brand them in a different way, or water them down, use slightly different language. But this, you know, famously in the late 1970s, Margaret Thatcher, you know, said things that were very similar to the British National Front, what it was saying, but, you know, did so in a different way to try and reduce their impact. When does that work, and when does it fail? And I know there's no simple explanation or answer for that, but maybe just tease out some examples that you've come across.
I find that it rarely works. In general, I think the balance, the preponderance of evidence suggests strongly that co-option legitimates the message, brings it into the mainstream. I mean, if there's kind of one, you know, central thing that's happened over the last 10 to 15 years, I think Kasmud is right on this, has been a mainstream of the radical right. And that has occurred through the process that you just talked about, you know, picking up the same messages. Why does it not work? Le Pen actually had this right. You know, why go for the, you know, the copy when you can have the original? And I think a lot of evidence suggests that that's how radical right voters feel. They see, wrongly in my view, but rightly in theirs, as radical right parties as owning. There's this concept called issue ownership in politics, of owning this issue on immigration. So it seems that whenever that's amplified, it's not that you're taking away, you know, it doesn't seem to be the mechanism that you say, oh, we mainstream voters are now reassured, we won't go to the radical right as a result of this. No, it really seems to, the more powerful effect seems to be that you make radical right voters solidified in their views and bring other voters over to the radical right as a result of amplifying those very messages. Of course, all parties try to do this to some degree, right? You see competitors, where do you want to have differences? Where do you want to have, you know, to steal their thunder, so to speak? So it's an extremely common strategy. You do see certain co-opting in cases where you have otherwise anti-pacting. So France would be a good example of this, right? Where, yes, I mean, Marine Le Pen and whatever the front, the French far right calls itself, has been credibly shut out of power for going on 30 odd years. But, you know, they can claim that they've had an enormous effect on discourse within France, on policies. Having said that, though, that remains a non-falsifiable claim, right? That the radical right can always trot out, and does. Marine Le Pen can say, look, you know, on the one hand, millions of votes have been wasted on the Front National, because the containment strategy in France keeps it shut out of power. But Le Pen can say, look at, we have changed the language. We have changed France as a result of this. How can you show that that's really the case? You know, you can't really. I mean, but the radical right doesn't run on sort of scientific messages, right? So it's really at home in that sort of environment. I mean, look no further than Austria too, if you want to look for trying to co-opt the radical right and thinking that will keep the FPÖ. Even scandal after scandal, it keeps coming back. You know, Sebastian Kurz was not the first Austrian prime minister to think that he could, you know, co-opt the radical right and perpetually, you know, keep its vote totals low.
Something that I really liked about your book was the fact that you said a lot of authors working on this subject hadn't really actually looked at the parties themselves or looked behind the leaders, for instance. You know, what's going on the ground? Who are the organizers? Who are the activists? So you pay a lot of attention, and, you know, this field work that you mentioned, you talk to over 140 people, I think, and you give some nice anecdotes of, you know, talking to some people from Republikaner, you know, party in Germany, who very much appear to be kind of the people who have nothing left to lose, you know, but then also these kind of very good looking, smartly dressed FPÖ activists as well, you know, this contrast.
Absolutely. I'll be happy to. A couple things to say first. One, that was the case at the time, right? There had not been a lot of field work and trying to get inside or do what, you know, do what political scientists in the United States do a lot of, to try to do somewhat ethnography, but let's not call it that, participant observation, but just elite interviews, really, at the end of the day. This had not been done before, not really tried. And it didn't prove to be all that difficult for me to, you know, locate people and to get them to agree to speak with me. I think that that two things have happened. One, it's more difficult to get some radical right people to speak with you now that they have more things to do, and are maybe also more aware of consequences. But two, and maybe more importantly, a change since the book is a lot of people have gone in and done field work, like do participant made that like their dissertation. So it's no longer true that 10 years later that there's little real engagement with radical right individuals themselves. But I did field work in lots of different countries and got, you know, somewhat different variations of the same basic story from different ones. So you mentioned the well-dressed at the time, not to say that clothes are a measure of anything, right? But going beyond perhaps the superficial, looking at people who had been in other political parties, had done relatively well in them, were employed. So interviews with those types, that would describe, you know, your typical Austrian FPÖ member at the time. You referred to Austria, so I'll talk about that there. But these are just, you know, pretty relatively ordinary politicians. I mean, sometimes, you know, incredibly boringly so, you know, just local politicians, not ideologically motivated. Sure, when you ask them all sorts of questions, you can get certain answers out of them. But would they have the sort of CV of the folks in the Republikaner? No. When I met Republikaner, a couple things were, you know, kind of obvious. One, it's a lot more difficult to track down parties that are not doing well, just finding the individuals. Two, you know, with the Republikaner, they were, you know, suspicious of outsiders. I did a lot of interviews with members of these parties, and I don't want to say that they were modernization losers in any sense, or that other portions of their lives were not, you know, great in some way. When I talk about they had nothing left to lose, it's that they did not fear politically or economically the consequences of membership, open membership in a radical right party. Now, when I interviewed those members, they were really intent on kind of showing me a couple of different things. One, they really did talk a lot about how difficult their lives had been as a result of radical right membership. I'd be interested to see, you know, 15 years on, if that's the same as it is, as it was then. My sense is it's probably changed somewhat for AfD members since they're much larger. But members of the Republikaner at the time, they loved talking about politics. They were political junkies and a lot loved history and going deep into discussions of German history. But they had major grievances. So they would come and show me, you know, their property that had been destroyed by anti-fascist activists. So some interviews would, you know, consist of an hour of that. Sometimes interviews with the Sweden Democrats, those were also sometimes difficult to track down. The Sweden Democrats were interesting because there were two parts of the party. One, that's still these are the leaders now, the same crew, many who I interviewed back then, who were educated at the University of Lund, most knew one another, and they seem very much like, you know, the types who I think would build successful parties in all types of countries. So that was one part of the Sweden Democrats. Others were very difficult to find, lived in isolated places, really had to track them down and meeting with them. You know, they were a lot more skeptical. They often brought tape recorders to make sure they were, you know, not being, you know, misquoted, which was fine by me. At the time, I mean, and this is something that was difficult to bring home in the book, I wanted to interview the activists to get a sense of what life was like for them, right? But you also saw this, you know, back in 2000, whenever I did the bulk of the field work, you just saw this in ordinary, you know, political events where if the Sweden Democrats, and things have changed, I know, but where if the Sweden Democrats were holding an event and I went to their annual conference and could do lots of interviews there, you needed police, you know, help in order to get in through the anti-fascist activists, to get through the various layers. so that you could get entrance. It was very much a feeling of living in a besieged kind of political identity. It's exactly what, you know, I got from all my interviews. That was the one thing that held them together of those unsuccessful parties that I talked about.
Brings me maybe to what you quoted Steve Bannon saying in the later article that you wrote just a couple of years ago about how people should embrace their views and wear it as a badge of honor, which maybe shows.
That's what Steve Bannon said, not me.
What Steve Bannon said, but it possibly shows how things have changed a bit. These activists that you mentioned, there's police protection is required, or there's severe kind of anti-fascist or anti-pact kind of groups potentially targeting them. Whereas today, you suspect that it's not as big an issue in terms of security and things like that. It's because it's become more accepted.
I suspect that's the case. I suspect that the automatic stigmatization and anti-fascism that I observed, routinely 20, now going on 20 years ago, is maybe not the same. I can't say because I haven't researched it, but it'd be interesting to speculate on.
The main contention of Inside the Radical Right is that when you're trying to explain why some parties fail and some parties succeed, you say that it's the quality of the people that these parties attract as activists, which determines whether they're going to be successful or not. You also developed a typology of radical right activists that you divided into three groupings: extremists, moderates, and opportunists. I think the extremists are probably a bit easier to typify, but the moderates and opportunists may be more complicated.
It's more complicated because these are not sort of general terms that, for all kind of like political identities. I meant them very specifically in the case of radical right parties. So you might say it's oxymoronic to talk about a moderate within the radical right. Well, so these terms are used specifically for members of radical right parties. That's the first point. Yeah, it sounds deductive, but it was really inductive and just kind of trying to say what big baskets, general baskets, do these activists, what are the categories that seem to really matter a lot? And this, was the big tripartite distinction that I came up with. And they really do seem to do mirror kind of the big three groups. The extremists, as you say, they're kind of easy and to identify, and numerically have historically in most radical right parties been the smallest group, although sometimes quite vocal. They are what the German state would define as a threat to the democratic order, that they are anti-democratic and openly racist or biologically racist to that degree. So they do not necessarily renounce violence as a form of a political organization. So take Golden Dawn in Greece. There are a number of extremists there, but that's not to say that they cannot be important forces within the party and help steer it in different directions. The opportunists are, at least for the radical right, as a relatively new party when I was studying it, one of the ways in which they got people was drawing from other places. And the opportunists were attracted to the radical right because they in general had not, unlike the extremists and the moderates, tended not to have a big political background, right? I mean, Donald Trump is in a way, he comes from many categories, but ultimate opportunist, right? So they came from other parties, minor celebrities or major celebrities. The radical right was because it needed people, right? It needed people in order to gain legitimacy. So it was, and having trouble attracting them. So anytime, whether it be in Austria or France, they got some minor TV presenter or Olympian or something like that, they ran with it. So those are those two categories. The moderates are kind of the toughest to understand, but they're, when Who Votes Radical Right, they are the core of the party that are kind of defined as, yes, they believe in democracy. They would say that they are not racist, but they are also would score high on any sort of anti-immigrant or nativism barometers. right? I mean, this is the core electorate of the radical right, really. So that's what I meant by in the book, the extremists, moderates, opportunists. I think it's interesting now to think, you know, about the connection with opportunists and commitment to democratic order, because we sort of assume that the opportunists would, you know, would be fine with democracy and democratic elections. But at least in the American context, you know, Trump raises all sorts of issues about that. I think in general, I mean, the big point of the book was that, well, how do people matter, right? What type of people, not judging their worth as individuals, but on kind of what more or less subjective scale can you use? And I used a widely, you know, respected scale of socioeconomic status, you know, in the book. But back to the big point, what role do individuals play in party building? And how do you think about that theoretically? So that was one big point of the book. And the second big point is that parties and states do have choices and whether they pact or anti-pact, right? And these choices have big consequences. And I think that in particular, you know, the organizational piece is important, but also this, you know, this, do you contain the radical right or do you try to tame it and allow it to, you know, thinking it will become smaller when in fact it usually becomes larger. Yeah, the organization matters. And I think that it still does matter, but the coalition markets or the pacting affects, you know, who gets drawn into the party too, right? For me, you know, American politics now, I'm just riffing a little bit here. Chris Christie has just dropped out of the GOP primary. And Chris Christie was, you know, if you remember back to 2016, the first major voice from within the Republican Party to say Donald Trump is okay, right? And then they started, you know, sort of collapsing one after another. Anyways, it really mattered. You know, that had consequences, right? And you can't put the genie back in the bottle, as Chris Christie has learned, you know, really the hard way. So yeah, it has consequences when, you know, of the type of individuals that you attract, how big the party becomes. You know, there's no consequences for being a MAGA Republican, you know, in America today. I mean, you might feel sort of strange in certain social circles, but it is not unless you've stormed the Capitol, it's not, they're not major consequences.
Yeah, some could argue there are negative consequences if you're not, in terms of primaries and things like that.
Well, absolutely. If you're seeking the Republican endorsement, yes. I mean, this is another thing that I find quite extremely interesting about Europe and in contrast with the United States, that electoral denialism was a non-topic, as far as I could tell, for the radical right. It never, ever, ever came up. Sort of the strategy of, you know, saying, oh, these are illegitimate, or going after the electoral commissions, trying to capture them, or tipping judiciary, all of this stuff, right? The radical right in Europe generally did not think in these terms at all, right? I'll be interested to see if that... you know, if that changes to some degree, if that's American exceptionalism or really individual exceptionalism, just one person who's driving this whole thing.
Well, one of the things that attracted me to your work and for this podcast is the fact that, you know, you say history matters. I know you work in political science, but, you know, your other book about Germany and Austria's debates about their Nazi past, for instance, also again highlighted how influential discussions about history are to the radical right. But what features in the inside the radical right, but also obviously in your other monograph, is the importance or the pertinence of the Holocaust and debates about the Holocaust. Now that we're coming up to, you know, nearly 80 years since the Holocaust, a lot of those survivors are passing away. Do you feel that it's less influential than before?
Even though you have the passing of the generations, right? That is not necessarily putting history to rest in any way, shape, or form. And I mean, look at the United States. We're battling in school boards over the Civil War. I mean, there's nothing about history that says it cannot really come back as an important political issue. And you know, the Nazi past, at least in Germany, has become such a part of political culture that I haven't seen no signs of that really changing. In fact, I see more signs. I see more signs of its endurance than anything else. Italy, you know, we are now at Italy. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Back to the point about stability of the radical right. And Italy was a country that did not, you know, engage in any sort of German type examination of its past. Not as a, you know, this is not casting aspersion on the Italian people necessarily. Some looked quite into the history and drew certain readings from it. But there was no consensus building in Italy, I think, about the role of historical memory in the same way that there was in Germany. And there was certainly not in Austria. But, you know, we're having the same debates about Italy and what role is the fascist past going to play when Gianfranco Fini became foreign minister in 1994 now. So, and now we have Giorgia Meloni, who's the, you know, the intellectual heir in all sorts of ways to Gianfranco Fini as prime minister. So, I mean, in some ways, it's just been a small jump in Italy in terms of the role that the far right has been playing over the last 30 years, but not a fundamental shift. And also the role of historical memory, no less important, right? I know this podcast, you know, podcasts date quickly, but you might have seen the salute, the fascist salutes that Giorgia Meloni recently got and is, you know, trying to deal with as effectively as she can. But this is an old problem for the Italian far right, right? You have individuals who are still attracted to historical fascism. You have many individuals who don't understand it at all. This probably is the lion's share, who don't understand it, but like the myths and rituals and symbols and go along with it. But, you know, as Italian prime minister, you can't really have that. But that's the ambiguous legacy, right? You could not imagine a politician in Germany taking even an ambiguous position toward Hitler, as politicians in Italy have taken toward Mussolini, and becoming any sort of, you know, reasonable figure. It just wouldn't happen. So to your big point, does history still matter? Absolutely. And in the United States, we are learning that it matters more, much more than we thought. And we're fighting about it in school boards and in primary campaigns, and we'll probably fight about it in the presidential campaign.
Yeah, and something else that really matters for you is nativism and opposition to immigration, that this is something that seems to unify all these radical right movements. You know, there are other things going on in terms of economic change and modernization and globalization and voter volatility and all these things. But this immigration and nativism seem to be something that they all appear to agree on, that they want to restrict or control in certain ways. Why is this reference to nativism so effective, in your opinion?
I wish I knew, honestly. I wish I knew. But what I can tell you is that pretty much in any Western European electorate, or an American electorate as well, at any particular time, you can get between 15 to 30% of the population with extreme anti-immigrant views. Why that is, I don't know. Why it's some indifferent, some higher in some societies and lower in others? Well, historical factors, obviously. Experiences with immigration and emigration, obviously in Ireland, right? That's a well-trodden explanation for the lack of a significant far right. Well, that and, you know, other things. But I don't have a theory for the appeal of nativism. What I can say is it's been with us since the birth of democratic politics, even though we haven't always looked at it that way. You know, look back at the role of nativism or, you know, white supremacy in the American South post-Reconstruction, and nativism too in interwar politics and political parties in all sorts of places. I think we tended as political scientists not to think about the importance of nativism for a while, because there was this period of 30 or so odd years, the end of the Second World War to up until about the 1970s and 80s, where it seemed that nationalism and nativism and all these things had gone away with the European integration project and, you know, capitalism providing all the goods so well. But I think in retrospect, it's that 30 years that's going to be the historical exception, that for whatever reason, nativism is going to be part of democratic politics. it is not possible, I don't think, to decrease the overall pool of nativist, you know, potential nativist voters in a population. What you can do from the supply side, and that's why it's so important, is to, you know, do all sorts of things that I talk about in the book and I've suggested elsewhere. Also, you know, another point on nativism is I wanted to stress that calling these parties populist is, and that was one of the point of the Myths of Global Populism article, that I think populism is not the appropriate way to think about these parties, and that their core message has always been native. It has not been, let's make democracy better, let's involve the common person. Their core message has been nativism and anti-immigration, and that, you know, plays whether or not they're talking about, you know, expanding democracy or not.
So do you think that it's not as global as maintained sometimes, you know, that it's very much a European, North American, and maybe Indian?
Some of this is kind of, I guess, a little bit pie in the sky theoretical, but I guess I'm not really willing to accept populism as a concept on scale with other, like democracy or authoritarianism, or that I can deal with. Populism has always, and there's been a long debate on, it's a deeply contested concept. And after kind of decades of thinking about it, I am more comfortable saying that populism is not something that we can necessarily wrap our heads around as a social scientific concept. In fact, I kind of pretend that populism doesn't really exist, because you can understand these parties perfectly well without, you know, calling them populist. We called them populist initially and really didn't, you know, think too much about it. This was 20 odd years ago, to differentiate them from other types of mainstream conservative parties or the old far right. So there's some sort of historic, you know, baggage to why we call them populist. And of course, Cass Mudde calls them populist, and he really sticks with this. I don't agree with Cass on this. I think that nativism is really their absolute core, undeniable feature, and populism is really very small part of it. But that's me. That's my own theoretical position on it.
Okay, thank you so much, David, for today. I love how you show that the radical right is not a homogenous group. It's quite varied. You know, you also show that demand-side explanations aren't sufficient to explain the success and failure of the radical right, that supply-side issues are really significant, particularly organization, appearance as well, you know, of activists. And we didn't touch on, let's say, how important leaders are, and also, you know, reactions to new technology, mass media, all those. But it is there in the books, which I would encourage people to go to. So, David, thanks again for taking the time out to discuss your work with us.
Again, thanks for the great questions. And to everyone who has read the book, thanks for plowing through it. I hope this has added more richness to the discussion.
You can find a huge range of podcasts and videos showcasing historical research on our website, historyhub.ie. You can also follow us on various social media, and if you want to get in contact with us about the series, please email info@historyhub.ie.